From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 653, DORA 2019, with guests Nicole Forsgren and Dustin Smith. Recorded Thursday, August 29th, 2019. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, go to soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. This is episode 653, and I'm bringing back one of my favorites today, Nicole Forsgren, who you've heard from a number of times doing research and strategy at Google Cloud following the acquisition of her startup, DevOps Research Assessment. That's DORA. She's also co-author of the book, Accelerating Software Performing Technology Organizations, and is best known for her work in measuring the technology progress as the lead investigator on the largest DevOps studies to date. Welcome back, Nicole.
Thank you. It's always fun to come talk about nerd stuff.
Always, always, always. And you brought another guest along. This is Dustin Smith, Dr. Dustin Smith, no less, a human factor psychologist and senior user experience researcher at Google. His research at Google has emphasized identifying areas where software developers can feel happier and more productive during development. Welcome, Dustin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I guess I'm among two PhDs today, so that's weird.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was super excited that Dustin joined DORA on this year's State of DevOps report, because I have to say it was kind of a throwback. It was like going back to being in academia again, when I could like throw ideas and be doing amazing analyses and like
and working from the shorthand that these doctors that don't know don't do nobody no good have. Is that what that is?
Yes.
Sir, doctor in house? Not that kind of doctor. No. No. Before we get rolling, I hate to even admit this. It's almost 3 years ago to the day the first time I published a show with you on it, Nicole.
And that was
the Science of DevOps show that we did. I believe it was at a ChefConf.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it's 3 years ago. And there was a couple of good comments on the show. And let me read you one of them. This is from Keith Williams. This is 3 years ago. And I think it's super relevant to what we're talking about here. I really identified with the examples in this episode. When I joined my current organization, we were exactly as you describe, the low performers, releasing every 6 months, including 2 to 3 months of testing and fixing, accumulating technical debt, scared of rework. We're now, I think, solidly into the middle ground with 2 weekly releases and a growing acceptance of regular rework to keep the code base clean. It turns out that releasing every 2 weeks is still too slow and actually increases some of the burden, not so much on development, but on professional services, sales, and marketing teams who are still used to the big releases tracked by Microsoft Project. We've also found that some clients are more conservative than others. Some due to culture, which can be changed, and some due to regulation, which is a bit harder to change. So we're moving into the interesting area where we deploy multiple rings of our app so the customers who want to stay evergreen can run in the fast ring, while others can stay on the slower rings or even pay us for a custom release. There's overhead in this, but also opportunity. And it would have all been possible without the effort to speed up our initial release pipelines. So enough waffling. Thanks for the great show. I forwarded around to my team.
Ooh, I hadn't heard that before. I like it.
Isn't that great? Yeah, it's a great story. And it's, you know, I know you have moments and I have moments where you feel like you're just sort of shouting into the void. And it's always nice when you get a little feedback from someone who actually listens to the show and can see themselves in what you're describing.
Yeah, it's kind of nice. And, you know, it's been interesting going through this journey for the last 6 years. Can you believe it? Six?
Yeah.
My little State of DevOps baby is going off to school.
Yeah. It's getting to kindergarten now.
It's interesting because when I first started doing this, I would have some people email me, ask for meetings. I would get on a call and they would request that I do a State of DevOps report for X, right? For a particular industry.
Right.
And that industry was usually highly regulated, right?
Right.
For finance, for telecom, for something.
Medicine,
they would insist they did not see themselves anywhere in it. And therefore, I had to do a research report just for them. And as we've kind of tracked the progress of the entire industry over time, we've seen that everyone's getting better. And this really echoes what the other industry analysts are saying, right? Mm-hmm. That everyone's really getting better, that excellence is possible. You just have to put in the work. I know I say the word just, right? It's like, I just have to go to the gym. Right. But I'm not really getting these calls anymore, accusing me, lovingly accusing me of excluding entire industries.
Right.
Instead, what I'm getting is questions about if I have strategies or tips or ideas of how to improve better or faster, because they are seeing improvements. Maybe they're struggling, but they're seeing improvements in themselves and they're seeing improvements in others.
And while staying compliant with the regulations that are relevant, although my experience,
exactly,
and I've done lots of work in finance, is there are very few regulations you can actually point to and say, that's going to impair a development process. I just don't really see that. That often it's like, we have to account for this in the development process, but it doesn't necessarily slow anything down if we choose these more rapid methods.
Yep, yep. You know what? Since you had that great opening on science, I was hoping that we could kind of dig into a few of our like science-y and stats-y things.
For sure. And plus, I've got two stats people here. Let me let Keith go here. So, Keith, thanks so much for your comment. And a Run As Radio mug is on its way to you. And if you'd like a Run As Radio mug, write a comment on the website at runasradio.com or via any of our social media. We publish every show to Facebook and to LinkedIn. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, I'll send you a Run As Radio mug. All right. Let's do a little statsy thing. What are you thinking? Take me on a ride,
okay,
a big number ride.
Okay, perfect. So one thing I wanted to mention, it just occurred to me, that's a perfect segue, is for years, we didn't see any difference in industry.
Hmm.
There were no significant differences, but this year we found one. And I'd actually love to see if Dustin wants to chime in on this.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to.
Perfect.
Yeah. So like Nicole said, over the past 5 years, we never saw any sort of effect with industry until this year. And we did see an effect, but really what was interesting is that almost all other industries, there was no effect on software delivery and operational performance, with one exception, and that exception is retail. And the results were such that retail was performing significantly better than all other industries.
Wow.
I love this, right?
Yeah.
Like, can we take
that was
one
not,
second to,
if you were
to
gonna,
stand back?
If you were
it's
gonna
not
ask
that
me,
anyone's doing worse.
You know, certainly nobody's doing worse, but if you were going to say which industry you think would be accelerating the most, I don't even think retail would make my top 10. So
right?
I'm, which means that I think it's a blind spot for me.
Or if anything, I always get people saying, well, we must be different because we're highly regulated. We're doing worse.
Right. That's really interesting. So this is the new DORA 2019 report published via the Google Cloud that we're talking about, where this data is?
Yep. The Accelerate State of DevOps report for 2019. And I think it's worth digging into why we think retail may be seeing these differences.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you know?
Well, Dustin, do you want to take this or do you want me to dive in? Oh, here's the problem. I get too excited. And Dustin led a bunch of these analyses. So I want to make sure I share.
Yeah, well, one thing that we're kind of hypothesizing is this whole big event of the retail apocalypse. You know, this industry has had a lot of pressure.
Oh, yeah, Amazon is eating the world, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, when Amazon has moved everything online, and obviously Amazon is one of these, you know, with their own cloud, they're very sophisticated as far as software delivery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone else has had to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that competitive environment could be one of the drivers for this effect that we found this year.
And that seems a very acceptable explanation of because it's a highly competitive space, they see DevOps practices as a competitive advantage. And so they're pushing harder.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. The other thing I love here is that you have to be competitive. You have to adopt so many practices or else you're not really there anymore, right?
Right.
If we think about, just like Dustin said, this retail apocalypse, we had a decade of closures. And so because of that, because you had to be so competitive in retail, retailers were among the first to embrace things like A/B testing so mm-hmm. that they knew their customers, buying habits and preferences and interactions. They, meaning retailers, some of the slimmest margins, right? So they embraced automation. They embraced scaling so that they could, respond to changes immediately. They also went to the cloud, just like Dustin said. They were some of the first companies to go there because they had to be able to burst with demand and capacity, right? I mean, look at Black Friday.
Yeah. I mean, is the business model. I'm also thinking concepts like omnichannel, where the average customer just expects to be able to order online, pick up at a store, get service via email. Like, all of those things just have to work together. And that's actually a ton of software.
Yeah. Order from your phone, pick it up anywhere, mm-hmm. right? You have to be able to order anywhere seamlessly, quickly, efficiently. And, you know, anytime someone says, oh, well, but we're highly regulated. So are retailers. They're processing credit card transactions.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And they have restricted products. They have all kinds of things that have regulatory requirements around them.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that you mentioned that, right? There are so many products that even cannot be shipped across certain state lines. So retailers have to understand and think about that constantly.
Right. And need age checks. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting. So here is an accelerating industry, which has all of the problems that would give them excuses not to do it. Is there any other hypotheses besides it's just such a competitive environment? Like, why else would these guys be accelerating like this?
I think that's one of the biggest ones, right? You have to be competitive. You have to embrace what some consider the forefront and the bleeding edge of technology in order to get ahead, right? They've had to embrace it and leverage it.
Is it still the forefront of technology?
Well, so I love that you say that because some people consider A/B testing to be cutting edge, but people in retail, absolutely not. They've been doing A/B testing on their websites for well over a decade.
Well, and also just that those continuous integration patterns, that's like that methodology of continuous improvement, because typically retailers aren't delivering software to their customers anyway. It's their backbone that their customers utilize. So they should never have big bang releases. They should be always improving.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Or at least pushing to a pre-prod environment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like you talked about omnichannel. End users don't want to be updating their shopping app every hour, every day. Of course not. But you can push to pre-prod and let them update every month. And then if you have an oops or a security fix that you need to push in every week, you know, like off cycle, you can, because it is a business decision and not a technology constraint.
Yeah. I think you want to over deliver on this side. So the customer is, it's not a bad thing for the customer to go, wow, you guys are moving really fast. There are worse problems as opposed to you guys are lagging behind.
Exactly.
Yeah, the part where you're lagging behind could lead to them just switching to a different platform or provider, right? If you any sort of downtime and they're just going to buy the product from somewhere else.
Absolutely. Well, and how else do customers vote these days than just with their feet? It's just like they just disappear. Like if you're not analyzing bounce rates, you're doing something wrong. Like how many people are showing at your site and leaving?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Another interesting finding that has never shown up before, and Dustin caught this one. So I'm going to let you be the spoiler on this one, Dustin, with enterprises.
Oh yeah, sure. So another surprise and in a factor that it's affecting our model is the size of the company. And specifically, we split the data by enterprise and non-enterprise.
Okay.
And what we're seeing is that the enterprise industries or organizations are performing significantly worse than the non-enterprise.
Now, hasn't that always been a trend that the sort of the bigger they got, the harder they were to move to these new patterns?
We haven't seen it in the past, though.
Mm, that's interesting.
Logically, it makes sense, but we haven't seen a statistically significant effect before.
So, yeah, and this is like our instincts say the smaller companies should be more agile, but your data just has not supported that.
Well, so they should be, but sometimes, I mean, who hasn't been at a startup and seen like real inefficient stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Or sometimes large companies can compensate for this by throwing money at the problem.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Although throwing money at agility seems unusual.
Well, I mean, sometimes what we think is happening here is that larger organizations are running into problems with change approval processes in particular.
Hmm.
Right?
And so now in 2019, you can see...
In particular, we're struggling with like cabs.
And so in 2019, you can see now that that this is what's holding up enterprises is the change approval process?
We think that we're able to tease that apart a bit more and growing complexity of infrastructure.
Because I would think that that the complex infrastructure is the continuous deployment infrastructure. You're thinking that enterprises have infrastructure that is not well suited to DevOps that is holding them back.
Well, so we have a few things, right? So many times when we are talking about much larger organizations, they are often also older organizations.
Right.
Right. And when we have older organizations, they tend to have more tightly coupled architecture.
Sure.
Right. That's where we will often have monoliths. And as these tightly coupled architectures and monoliths start growing and they become more complex, they are much harder to deal with.
Hmm.
And we're starting to see this in many of the organizations that we're, and when I say we, right here, I'm talking about the Dora team, right? So the teams that we're working with when we're working with our assessment tools. And so when we're talking about these really large organizations, we're also talking about highly regulated organizations. Mm-hmm. So these things are interrelated, right?
Back to that regulation concern.
Yep. So how do we deal with that is we often introduce more process to deal with this. And as our organizations get bigger and we're dealing with more tightly coupled architecture and more process, this sometimes just means that we have more people to talk to, more gates to pass,
right,
more approvals to get. And sometimes it's, as Jess Humble calls it, change management theater.
Right.
Maybe we're just passing spreadsheets back and forth. All it does is introduce delay.
Yeah, and hard gates where that person having the day off means nothing happens that day.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right? And in particular, when we're dealing with these large, tightly coupled architectures and the combination with process, it really makes things difficult to deal with. And that problem is only going to be compounded in really large organizations where you have to span a large organization to get anything done.
For sure. And I'm going to interrupt for one moment here for this very important message. This episode of Run As is brought to you by SQL Intersection. 8 full-day workshops and over 40 technology-focused sessions make SQL Intersection a unique source for the best information for SQL Server from real-world consultants and members of the SQL Server team. You'll learn proven problem-solving techniques and technologies you can implement immediately, as well as learn about the future of SQL Server. Get answers to performance monitoring, troubleshooting, designing for scale and performance, cloud, as well as the new features in the latest version of SQL Server 2019. It's time to determine your migration strategy, and SQL Intersection is the place to figure out the best way to do it. Come to SQL Intersection at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, November 18 to 21. Use code RUNAS to get a discount on your registration at SQLintersection.com. See you there. And we're back. It's Richard Campbell. This is Run As Radio. I'm talking to Nicole Forsgren and Dustin Smith and talking about the challenges that large organizations have around DevOps. Although I will recall an earlier show I did with Rosalind Radcliffe where we talked about DevOps and mainframes.
I am so glad you brought this up. I love Rosalind.
She's amazing. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yes. And you know what? This is such an important point because I mentioned, and I, or at least I tried to. So let me make sure I articulate this really, really carefully. There are mainframes and there are mainframe computer systems, mm-hmm. and there are separately tightly coupled architectures.
Right.
So those are two different things. And I think that traditionally many people conflate the two. You can have smartly architected, more loosely architected mainframe systems.
Yeah.
You can absolutely move quickly. You can have software development and delivery. You can have stability and throughput in mainframe systems. And Rosalind Radcliffe and her group at IBM, they're doing some really interesting, innovative things there.
And admittedly, in the conversation, we were talking about very contemporary mainframes, which made me concerned around folks that have sort of stepped off keeping their mainframes the most up-to-date and using older versions of software and so forth, that may well be, as you've described, more tightly coupled and harder to be more agile with.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? To be fair, we can also be talking to, and I have spoken with, new startups that are cloud native that are monoliths.
Interesting.
What's the joke? If you haven't had a monolith, it just means that you haven't been successful.
Right. Yeah, you're not there yet.
You can architect something poorly, or maybe it's a reasonable architecture. If you're successful fast enough and you just don't have time to re-architect it and decouple it, right? Like you end up with a monolith. You can absolutely architect something in the cloud and just not architect it the right way. And you can end up with a monolith in the cloud. I've seen it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the cloud won't protect you from bad architecture.
No, it will not. And the mainframe doesn't doom you to bad architecture.
Right.
What matters is architectural outcomes. Mm-hmm, can your team test, deploy, without fine-grained communication and coordination among different members of the team? That's what's important.
And do you think, are there places where they have to sort of hunt for that agility? Like, how do we find a way to decouple this to make it easier for us to cycle independently?
I don't know if we need to hunt for it. Like, there are smart ways to look at doing that, right? So there's like the 12 factor. Mm-hmm. And there's, if you're starting with a tightly coupled architecture, you can move forward with things like Strangler architectures and things like that.
So looking through the 2019 report, the other thing I've noticed is the elite pool got bigger by a lot, like more than double.
Yes. Yes. Almost triple, actually.
Wow. Yeah. That's astonishing.
So, and I think it's important to point out here that some of this comes down to definition. And mm-hmm. I want to point that out because there have been a couple people on Twitter lately who have been like jumping into my mentions saying, that's not possible. Not everyone can be an elite performer. We're not all Netflix. And I'm like, listen, it's about what is possible in terms of software development and delivery.
Yeah.
And the way we define elite performers is, can you deploy on demand? Is your time from is your lead time from changes, so commit to deploy, less than a day? Can you restore, time to restore service, is that less than an hour? And is your change fail rate between 0 and 15%? So last year, our elite performers were a subset of our high performers. It was about 7%. This year, that subset broke out into their very own group. And it's 20% now. So what that's telling us is a few things. One is that, the whole industry is really kind of getting better. Other analysts have said DevOps has crossed the chasm, everyone's getting better. This is a nice confirmation of that in that it is possible to get better. You just need to execute on the capabilities, things like test automation, continuous integration, deployment automation, so that when you go faster, you are more stable.
Right.
Right. And some people look at it the other way. When you're more stable, it also enables faster software delivery. And, the saying, day one is short, day two is long. You also have better availability. These things all enable one another. So we're not talking about deploying thousands of times per day, although many companies are. We're just saying, can you deploy when you need to?
Yeah, on demand.
on demand.
Yeah, and for the most part, successfully. It's interesting that one of the capabilities is being able to roll back, but at the same time is, and you never need to.
Or if you do need to, can you do it relatively quickly?
Right.
Is it relatively painless when you need to debug something because something goes wrong in production? Because it will, right? We work with highly complex systems. Can you restore service in less than an hour? Can you keep your systems up? Because it is about delivering value to your customers and your end users.
And looking at the numbers here and seeing you've clearly split the elite performers off from the high performers, and the elite performers jumped up to 20%, which is huge. But it also made the high performer block, which was 48 in 2018, with 7% of those being elite, now being 23. Like, did the medium performers actually get larger? Did we regress?
They did. So last year, as you pointed out, that high performance group was 48%. This year, what was our high performance group is 43%, right? So the elite performers plus the high performers, that 20 plus 23 is 43%. Mm-hmm. So the high performance group shrunk a little bit. So medium performers are now 44%. It grew. So in some ways, this is good. Our low performers dropped from 15% to 12%. So again,
that's progress.
Industry is getting better. Now, though, a few of our high performers fell. It's like, why is this? We think that some is because, you know, as we were just chatting about, some may be struggling with complexity. Mm-hmm. We think that some are likely responding to changes in environment, changing in context, changes in regulation by introducing more process approval boards, right? We see this happen a lot. And what happens then is you then struggle under the weight of this additional approval.
Are we going to lay this at the feet of GDPR?
Not necessarily. There's been a lot of things that happened. GDPR mm-hmm. happened. Security incidents happened.
Oh, goodness,
privacy
yes.
incidents happened. Other types of regulation happened. And anytime something happens, like a thing, right? Whatever thing happens, whether it happens to you or it happens to another company or organization in your field, what happens? We often react initially by instituting controls.
Right.
And we can even say, you know what, we will do this initially. We will do this for a time, right? For weeks or months or an indeterminate amount of time. We will put these controls in place for now while we figure this out. And then, like, for this next amount of time, we will do, like, increased controls. We will have, like, increased diligence while we institute new policies, while we institute additional automation, while we institute additional something. And then in 2 weeks, 2 months, something, we will roll back those controls once we have improved performance, improved availability, improved security.
Right?
The problem is that as soon as you put that gate in place, everything else follows.
Right.
It is like a snowball. You have now slowed everything down.
Yeah.
So now all of those changes batch up. Everything slows down. So what happens when you do that? Everything slows down. Everything batches up. You have now increased the batches that finally hit production.
Yep.
When you have that, you have increased blast radius. That increased blast radius increases the likelihood that a change will fail. When that change inevitably, like, hits, when you do have an inevitable change failure, you also have more difficulty identifying what the failure is.
Because the scope of your change was larger.
Exactly. I was chatting with Dustin about this. He said it was very much like doing experiments, right? Now, instead of doing one experiment, you've done 10 or 100 experiments, right? You don't know which one which experiment caused the failure.
Well, and they inevitably interact. It may be more than one.
Exactly, exactly. And then when you need to fix it or roll it back or do something, it takes longer. So your time to restore service is longer. And so you had the best of intentions. I understand why all these companies do this, but those good intentions had all of these far-ranging effects. And so then how are you going to catch up? That's the difficulty of so many of these things. And it's particularly difficult at these large companies, which is related to what Dustin just shared about the enterprises.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dustin, in your bio, you mentioned specifically around developer happiness. Is this something you quantify with these kinds of processes as well? Like, can you see that development teams are happier when they work in these more contemporary ways?
Well, from this year, the way that at least the State of the DevOps report has gone about this is we look at our developers using tools that are easy to use and that they want to be working with. But in my experience, yeah, we try to capture that with a lot of the products that Google develops for developers as well, and making sure that what we're giving them is actually satisfactory. So yes, in two ways, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's just an interesting thing to measure. I'm an advocate in the Gene Kim camp as well, and I've talked about and have witnessed teams that get to a place where they are experimenting on these projects. So they are making hypotheses and working together on problems and really enjoying themselves doing it. You know, it's a lot less sort of the personal, you have to get this right, and the more of a, I wonder why that happened. You know, let's go explore it, which is a lot nicer way to work. It's just, to me, an interesting thing to measure, to say, you know, are we 10% happier? Is I think a tough number to prove.
Yeah, absolutely. Important to assess whether people are actually enjoying what they're doing, which, you know, it also leads into some of the addition of looking at burnout this year in the State of the DevOps report, which Nicole probably could speak to.
Yeah, so we've looked at burnout a couple of years. The thing that was interesting this year is that we also found that if we study productivity and the right kind of productivity, that productivity can help with work-life balance, and mm-hmm. that work-life balance also helps reduce burnout. I really liked kind of the chain through looking at useful, easy-to-use tools that Dustin just talked about, and how that helps increase productivity and engineering productivity. And then engineer productivity helps contribute to that work-life balance that we just talked about. One of the insights that Dustin reminded me of, though, was that useful, easy-to-use tools are particularly helpful and useful and important for experts in our systems. And it was something I touched on early in my dissertation research, because when we think about the people running complex technical systems, mm-hmm. so often we just ignore we know that it's important, but many times people who are like making procurement decisions just forget about it, because they're like, well, they're already experts. And Dustin shared this like awesome tidbit and this awesome like history story for me that I had never heard before. Dustin, do you want to share that? The one that we included in the report? I don't want to like give the teaser because it's so good.
That's referring to like how people are essentially bound by the system that they're operating in.
That one, but also the one out of, I think it was World War II.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm by training a human factors psychologist. Mm-hmm. And that branch of psychology is actually born out of pilot selection from the World Wars. And so when we were first starting to introduce aviation to warfare, we kept having people have a lot of mishaps with flight. With the first immediate reaction was that we wanted to select the people that were, you know, best suited to be pilots. You know, how can we identify the right person for the job? And over time, what we really started to realize is that these systems were just so complicated that it was impossible to pick the right people, because the system was too complicated for people. And really what this industry was born out of is trying to design systems, environments, ecosystems that are best suited for the people that are actually going to be operating them. So, you know, redesign the cockpit. And if you apply that to the IT industry, you know, we need to build systems around developers that are best suited for them and not try to just hire the best developers.
Sure. No, well, it was aircraft engineers that built cockpits. It was pilots that had to fly them, and they're not the same people.
Absolutely.
And I certainly had the experience that the kind of people that are good at building tools for developers are also not the kind of developers that would use those tools.
Yep. Or...
there can absolutely be a disconnect there.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, like, the crazy, sometimes funny thing is that occasionally you do have the people who are building the systems also users, but then you have this weird disconnect where they're like, well, I built it. It works for me, right?
Yeah.
Well, it runs on my system.
Yeah.
Like, well, it's not, but you aren't representative of all
users.
Yeah,
you're not the customer.
Right. You have a lot of...
Right. You're not every developer.
You're also a lot of bias in terms of just you have a lot invested into that tool now.
Yeah.
You a lot of almost tunnel vision when you're making it and forgetting about who else will have to use it.
Well, and the person who has to, how little attention the person who has to use it pays to it compared to what you pay to it.
Yeah, just by architecting it.
Yeah. Well, and just by the nature of you built this thing, so you pay a lot of attention to it, mm-hmm. where most people are going to give it a cursory glance and that's about it. And if they don't get what it does at that point, they're probably going to ignore it.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting to just think about how much the friction of the tools affects their mind state for all of these things. So I'll include a link to the report. Any other things people should be looking at?
Gosh, there's so much. I know I say that every year.
Mm-hmm.
But because we had... two trained researchers on the report this year. We were able to dig into so much more. We actually have two fully predictive, I guess not fully, let me start over. We were able to dig into so much more this year. We have two predictive research models. We have a lot of additional analysis, even looking into things like what tools organizations are using, what types of integrations they're using. We look into disaster recovery testing. Pro tip, everyone, please do more disaster recovery testing. I'm scared for the world.
Yeah, before the disaster strikes, please.
if you never test your backup, is it ever actually there?
Nobody needs a backup strategy. They need a restore strategy.
Yes, exactly. Same thing with our dirt testing. We're not doing it enough.
Yeah.
And not just for the disaster, for the teams and for the processes it supports.
Yeah.
There's so much. I'm like scrolling through the report right now. I just want to say, just like read the whole thing. Do it over time. It's a lot. I'm sorry.
And where are folks going to see you and Dustin in the future? Are you going to be at the Microsoft Ignite event or are there other events coming up that you're going to be hanging out at?
We are heading to DevOps Enterprise Summit, where we are going to try to figure out what our favorite parts of this report are, and we're going to tell the world.
Awesome.
Very excited.
Yeah, I've done a few of those, too.
Yeah.
All right. Nicole Forsgren, Dustin Smith, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.